Welcome to Commons Conversations, a series of interviews with campaigners sharing their experiences and insights into activism, learning in movements, radical history, and more. This episode is from our second series and was originally broadcast by Community Radio 3CR. It features a conversation between Holly Hammond, Director of the Commons Library, and Rochelle Porteous, the Advocacy Manager at the Council for Intellectual Disability. Rochelle discusses some key wins as well as insights into messaging and organising that she's drawn from a rich history of campaigning. The podcast is produced by the Commons Social Change Library, a website containing over 1,000 resources for campaigners, which can be accessed for free at commonslibrary.org. The library contains many other podcasts, including other episodes in the Commons Conversations series.
So, Rochelle Porteous from Council for Intellectual Disability, maybe to start with, if you can give us a bit of a sense of how you first got involved in activism or advocacy or campaigns yourself.
I've always obviously been very interested in the communication side, and I guess I started my journey in film, working initially as a script writer and also then moving into directing mainly short films and some documentary work. But then I got quite involved politically in a number of local campaigns, and it really awoke in me the importance of communications and the importance, what really fired me up and still does today, is empowering people to be able to campaign for themselves. And seeing that light bulb moment happen when people realise that, and it might sound a bit cliche, but when they realise they actually have a voice and that people are listening to them and that there's power in what they've got to say and that they don't have to self-edit 24/7 what they're saying, because the honesty and the rawness of and the passion that they bring to what they're saying is what is the compelling message that they're giving people. And I guess then I've obviously had a lot of experience in a political space. I have spent many years as an elected representative as well in local council. So I've been a councillor and a mayor, and that's also where you further get involved in local campaigns and really get down to the how do you win campaigns that seem impossible to win. And you often work with community groups where you don't win the campaign. But I've so often had happened to me that people will say, we haven't won a campaign. You know, we didn't win, but we got heard. You know, we got acknowledged. Our issues were listened to. And although we didn't win this campaign, we're coming away from it in a much better space, because we know that we tried and we were listened to and we fought to get a better outcome. And then you get the ones that you win, which obviously are the highly motivating campaigns where you really do change things for the better. And certainly in a space, I mean, obviously a lot of my campaigning in employment is at a state and a national level, because I've worked for different organisations like Greenpeace, for example, and I've worked on campaigns like the Kevin 07 campaign, the campaign to eradicate poverty worldwide, and social justice campaigns, and a lot of domestic violence, childhood sexual abuse. I've worked in a lot of different spaces, and often in a campaigning role in those spaces. But whether you're working with a group of 10 residents in your local community, or you're working across Australia with, you know, thousands of people, they're not that different, really, the campaigns. Really, it's really about empowering and activating and, you know, doing your research, doing your power mapping, you know, mapping out where the power lies in the campaign, who it is that you have to move in order to effect change, strategizing how that change is going to happen, doing your critical pathway to identify the one or more, and usually it's more than one, pathways that when followed will achieve your outcomes. And then looking at the communities that you're working with and how you work specifically with those communities. So, for example, working now at the Council for Intellectual Disability, my core community is people with intellectual disability, which is an interesting space and a challenging space to work in, but a very rewarding space to work in, because I work with people with intellectual disability who want to have their own voice, who want to make their own decisions, and who want to have their own campaigns that are campaigns that they have chosen to run on their issues in their way, and that they are part of that process all the way through. So, and I find it very rewarding, but also very liberating, actually, to work with people with intellectual disability, because I always find perspectives very original and often take me in directions I didn't expect to go. But when I go there, I think, yeah, actually, that really works. But that's completely different to, say, working with a group of fired-up environmentalists who want to save whales, or who want to stop coal-fired power stations. There's each community that you work with are completely different, and you need to read your community really well to understand how you can motivate them and how they can be activated along the pathways that you want them to follow in order to become powerful advocates for that particular campaign that you're campaigning on.
There's obviously been a lot of campaigns in your life, like I'm really getting a sense of the different kinds of scales, the different topics, the different realms, you know, and also being a councillor and a mayor, you would have been on the other side with people seeking to influence you to get outcomes from the council that they were wanting as well. So kind of where you're positioned, you have a different picture on like what makes campaigns effective. And yeah, I really liked how you also set out some of those elements of an effective campaign, the kind of strategy work that you do in the lead up and the relationships you build and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I have to be honest, I mean, I guess I have become increasingly professional in my campaigning, also because of all of the community campaigns that I've been part of. I've seen what worked, what hadn't worked, where things, you know, have gone awry, and how to correct that. And certainly one thing you often don't have with campaigns that are can happen very quickly, need to happen very quickly, you don't get the luxury that you often do, say, with a campaign run with an organisation, to actually sit down and do that serious research that is so critical to a successful campaign. I mean, some of the campaigns that I've run with the organisations that I've worked with, I've literally done months of research before getting to the next stage in the planning, because then you know what are the asks, what's the problem, how the problem has arisen, what is the solution, so what are the asks going to be, who are the people that can address those asks and can resolve it, how do I get to them, and what is going to be, you know, that critical pathway that is actually going to lead to success. And it's always really interesting, I find. I was actually doing a debrief the other day with colleagues on a campaign that we ran leading up to the recent state election. It was a disability inclusion campaign called every day for everyone, make inclusion happen, which will be ongoing quite likely after the election because we've got some really good outcomes, but there's more to build on. But actually reviewing the critical pathway that I'd written, well, you know, almost 12 months ago, it was really pleasing to see how much of that that had been followed. It was very organic in the sense I didn't go back to the path and go, what next? It becomes a very organic sort of progress from one element to another element, and everybody takes on their particular roles. Like we have a very strong lobbyist who takes on some of that really deep lobbying work that needs to be done. And others take on, you know, more of the social media work, and others take on more of the organising work. I do oversight of all of those elements and keep driving it in the right direction, or moving the direction as needs be, because what I find with campaigning is that you have to be very fluid and flexible and nimble in the way that you approach campaigns, because the way the world is today, it can be quite different tomorrow. And that's not just the big ticket items like a change of government. Could be a smaller thing like a change of minister. But very often it's just an announcement that might come out overnight from government, which completely moves your goalposts, and you have to completely rewrite your campaign in 48 hours in order to address what suddenly has become a different way that you're going to have to approach the campaign. And to be honest, that happens all of the time. Yeah. I find with campaigning, that nimbleness that you need to have in your approach.
Yeah. So value in doing the research, value in coming up with a plan, but also that these plans are kind of living documents and that your campaign is going to need to respond to a shifting circumstance. So, But having a strategic outlook, you know, when those changes happen, means you're also able to choose how you respond that fits in line with the kind of strategy you've thought through, hey?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And you mentioned as well the campaigns you win that are, you know, such a source of inspiration and motivation for everybody. Are there campaign wins that you'd like to share about? And I'm thinking particularly around campaigns for people with disability. You talked about disability inclusion campaign, but there might be ones around people with intellectual disability, big campaign wins that you want to acknowledge.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, we've had a lot of campaign wins. I don't stop until I win, actually.
Fantastic.
And sometimes, you know, tenacity is probably one of the most important elements in campaigning. You know, you don't stop. You do keep going, because it is the one that keeps going when others have fallen off that will have actually win the campaign. And if it's you as the campaigner to change, you will win. But it's very, very hard to keep going, and that's where the real challenges are. In fact, if you've got a great group of people who are really motivated and focused, including the people that you're campaigning for as well, makes a huge difference to that motivation will just keep you going. Look, there was a campaign, I was actually talking to a colleague of mine about it today. It was called the Hard to Swallow campaign, which we ran back in 2018, 2019. With the Council on Intellectual Disability. It was the campaign about dysphagia, which is the difficulty in swallowing. A lot of people with intellectual disability also have dysphagia. And it's when there was the transition to the NDIS from the previous system and from health, somehow in the mix of this, the therapies that support people with dysphagia got that instead of the NDIS taking them on board as being, because these are people with permanent disabilities, and the therapies really can be a big difference between how well they can function day-to-day in the community. If the therapies are maintained, this is like particularly speech therapy, but also, you know, occupational therapy, then they can function reasonably well. And, for example, for one young woman, it was the difference between her potentially choking every night and being able to sleep through the night, which had terrible impacts on her family, particularly on her young brother, because when we interviewed him, you know, he would say that, you know, when they took the therapies away, it was just terrifying because every night he would start to hear his sister choke, and he knew that he had to get up quickly and go and help her to stop choking because she was unable to swallow properly. And just the, you know, the trauma that it was he was experiencing as a young, it's only about 11, I think, or 12, and his sister was, I think, 14. And they were very close, obviously, as well. And the basically NDIS have refused to take on these therapies and fund them. But Health had turned around and said, well, we're not funding them because it's the responsibility of the NDIS. So what happened was in the middle lie the people who have dysphagia who and their families who are no longer getting the therapies, unable to fund them themselves. The health professionals who are saying, this is essential, and sometimes even providing the therapies for free because they knew that it was a life and death situation. Terrible, terrible situation, which was being ignored by the NDIS and basically, you know, swept under the carpet. So we started the campaign with a story, which was a very compelling story of a mother with her daughter. And that we ran that for quite a while. It got a great response, but we just couldn't get it over the line. We lots of lobbying, lots of advocacy, but we couldn't get it over the line. So we then found another story, which was a story I just told you about with the young brother and the family, and we, you know, filmed their story in a video, and we got out and we really pushed that story really hard. We had all of our members with ID going and talking to the local MPs, and we got a great activation right across the ID community and our membership and our supporters to go and talk to as many members of parliament as possible. And then we got the media on board as well. They really embraced the story. So we got some good articles up on it. And we managed to spook the government. You can edit that one out. But basically the government started listening. And then they made a promise that they would address it. We got an article in The Guardian and they said, yes, this is a serious problem. We will address it. They did nothing. So we got another article up in The Guardian, really damning them. And that time, like, we got a phone call within 24 hours. We've done it. We've changed the rules. Now everybody's going to be funded for dysphagia. And they did. And so suddenly our family, they got called up and said, yes, you're being funded. The family we'd worked with before, yes, you're being funded. But the wonderful thing about this was that it really took a long time. And we could have given up after stage one because we were like, we thought we'd come to them and said, no, we can't give up. Let's give it another go. Let's find another story. Let's make it even more compelling than the first story. Let's really push it out. Let's push hard, get our members totally activated on this one. And we did, and that was successful. But the wonderful thing as well was once we did win that, there was then an acknowledgement that the NDIS had not funded a whole lot of allied health therapies because of this gap, if you like, between the NDIS and health. And so it ended up, you know, being beneficial to not just people with dysphagia, but, for example, for people with diabetes, for people with incontinence issues. There are about there were seven or eight different areas, and I think the final number was about 63,000 people were benefited from this particular campaign that we ran, because it changed the mind of government and they realised that they had to fund these therapies, because by not funding them, they were actually putting people's lives at greater risk. And yes, and I think that the final I don't like saying cherry. what was particularly pleasing when there was, after the federal election, because it was in the shadow of the federal election that we were running this. So straight after Scott Morrison got re-elected, but he made a point of inviting CID members and to meet with him and to acknowledge the work that CID had done in terms of changing the rules in the NDIS. So, yeah, that was a really, really good campaign.
That's an awesome campaign win. And the way that it shows the power of a good story, hey? So that both stories are important.
I'm sorry. Sorry, don't worry.
No, but that a story that is going to have an impact, it's going to, you know, be picked up by the media, but also that your members and supporters, it really resonates with them so that they're going to be telling the story as well, and really, yeah, amping up that impact. And the other thing I hear in that campaign is that you weren't afraid to, like, hold their feet to the fire. So, you know, kept trying, and then, you know, just kept that pressure up until they're like, hey, stop it, no more pressure, we've done it, we've made the change. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, and I think, like, you're right, the narrative is really important. Having compelling stories is something that I always look for in campaigns, because it just really makes the issue accessible to everybody. Because if you say dysphagia, even if you say somebody has difficulty swallowing, it's like, yeah, well, whatever, you know. It's just when you actually see a person understand, see the impact on the family, you know, and hear the story from the mum and from the brother about what happens and how terrifying it is when their daughter and sister can't swallow, and you hear from the allied professionals about how easily it is addressed and remedied, because as soon as she got back onto the therapies, literally within a week, she was sleeping through the night and no longer had any choking. I mean, that's how easy it was to remedy.
Yeah.
Without those therapies, she was at risk every night.
Yeah, it does also show, you know, that power of a logic in the campaign where there's a problem but there's a solution, and the only thing that's getting in the way of the solution is, you know, the political will or whatever other barrier it is that the campaign can, you know, look to get in there and shift that situation. So the tenacity is really coming through. How do you decide when it's not your battle or when it's time to kind of pass the baton to other people?
I tend to be a person who says yes too much. So that is something I'm trying to address, because that's actually not sustainable. I do think there's a point where you, as a campaigner, you do step back and let a campaign continue, but let other people come out as the leaders in the campaign. So you can be, if it's a community campaign, you can be a leader for quite a period of time and then say, well, this has got to a good stage. There's a lot of people here who know what they're doing. There are leaders here who can carry this forward. I don't need to be a leader anymore in this space. I'm going to step back because I want to concentrate my efforts now on this other campaign that I haven't been able to give much of myself to, because I've been so involved in this campaign. So you step back and let others lead. I do believe in leading from behind. I think that's important in all campaigns, including the campaigns that I run in the disability space. That's why I think co-design is so important. And in fact, All of our campaigns are co-designed from the start, and right throughout the campaign, they're co-designed. And I think it's important that you identify early who your spokespersons are. I never spokes on any of the campaigns. Perfectly happen to. I'm actually a really good public speaker, but I prefer to help people write their speaking, write the speaking notes. So enable them. Enabling is, I think, what I think is more important than taking personal, you know, accolades, if you like.
Yeah.
Because that's totally unsustainable to do that. A campaign needs lots of leaders and it needs lots of voices. Mm. And if you've got the skills, you should be providing that support from behind.
Mm.
There's times when you need to be out front, but most of the time it's more effective to be behind.
Yeah, it's a good organising approach, hey, to be thinking about how to develop others to step into that space. And then especially where people have lived experience of the issue that's under question, you know, so it's so important to have those voices to being heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Earlier on you said about something you really enjoy about working with people with intellectual disability is that they come up with different ways of doing things, you know, so maybe surprising and creative responses or just different ways. Can you maybe share some examples of that?
So I guess things like when we're doing our, you know, logo development and our messaging development and our framing development. So we do some initial work and then take it to our, we have an advocacy group, which is about, it's 12 to 15 people who come to most of the sessions, and we workshop that with them and get their feedback and their ideas and that. And what I found, for example, in a recent campaign that we were running on disability inclusion, was I think we were really locked into don't lock us out or else it's not optional as being what we thought would really resonate with our members with intellectual disability. And in fact, they totally rejected both of them for good reason. You know, it's not optional, they felt was could be misinterpreted, and you know, what's not optional, and they gave a whole lot of good reasons that which were perfectly valid. And I said, yeah, absolutely, you're totally right. We shouldn't use that one. And then that don't lock us out. I said, you know, it's why do you have to be so negative? Like, we want to be positive. We don't want to be negative. He said, more people will like the campaign if you make it a positive campaign.
Mm.
So we had another one there, which was Every Day for Everyone.
Mm.
And they said, that's the one we like. It's positive. It's saying things that's what we want. We want to be, you know, we want to be the same as everyone else. We want every day to be the same, and we want to be part of everyone. We're everyone. Mm. I said, yeah, that's it. You know, they totally nailed it. That's what we should call the campaign. But they said, you have to go a step further. They said, you haven't said about inclusion. You need to put inclusion in there. I said, okay, so how would you do that? And they said, well, what about you say every day for everyone, make inclusion happen, or make disability inclusion happen? I said, yeah, that's really good. Okay, we'll do that. So that became our tagline, basically. Mm-hmm. And we developed, you know, all our material based on that. But it was their insight into what worked. And while they were looking at it from an intellectual disability perspective, I think they actually captured a sort of a universal truth there, which was beyond intellectual disability, because they actually made it more accessible for everybody.
Yeah.
And more appealing as well. Mm. So it was a really great way for them to, you know, be part of that process and actually together for us to come out with a better outcome than we would have.
Yeah. The Commons Library, we're early days in our journey with EasyRead, but as we've been like translating different campaign resources, that discipline to try to go for the most simple, most clear way of communicating the information and to find the images that match up with it. Like, it's a great discipline that I think would help people in communication in lots of ways. So, you know, thinking about what makes things inclusive for people with intellectual disability, it extends to inclusion for others as well. And in terms of, coming up with a name of an advocacy campaign to be like, no, take out the words that are confusing and find the words that are clear, and also managing to encapsulate like the values and the vision of the campaign in the title is a great achievement. What do you think makes a good ally to people with intellectual disability? So if people who are involved in, you know, other campaigns or in their community are going to have contact with people with intellectual disability, are there ways that you see, good approaches in terms of how to work together?
How to work effectively with a person with intellectual disability? Value them, listen to them, treat them as if they're your work colleague, treat them exactly the way that you would treat any other work colleague. That's exactly what they want as well. They are our equals, and we need to absolutely be authentic with them, just as we are with all our other work colleagues. Acknowledge as well, though, where there is more support needed. I guess with different people that I work with who have intellectual disability, they will have different needs. That might be, for example, that it's quite difficult for them to remember things. So as a general rule, if we've got a meeting or a workshop upcoming, we would do a lot more reminders to make sure that they know, including one on the day, and we just remind them again of the place and the time. They may have difficulty orienting themselves. Sometimes, for example, they might arrive at Central Station and forget, or just be disoriented about how they get from Central Station to the office. So we plan that into things so that we've got one person on standby who can go down to Central Station if needed, and just walk with somebody up to the office if they're feeling a bit disoriented. We do a lot of, obviously, when we're doing work presentations and everything like that, we always use Easy Read. Awareness of what else? I'm a bit of an advocate for also having unfiltered communications as part of what I do, because the world is unfiltered, and I think that it's important also to create a balance there between communications that are in Easy Read but also unfiltered communications, to help to work your way through those so that you can still find the critically important information in that information. Mm-hmm. So, we do work with material as well that's unfiltered, to make sure that there's a balance there. But it's really important that the critically important information is always presented in Easy Read.
That's all really great.
Yeah, I mean, for example, we're doing a lot of campaigning at the moment on transport for people with intellectual disability. In fact, we have for many years done a lot of campaigning in that space, because there's a lot of issues, which wayfinding is an issue, signage is an issue, in terms of it being easy for people to see signs and know what that sign means, or to see directions and to know where to go. Timetables are very hard to read. 24-hour timetables are very hard to read. Definitely the preference is for 12-hour timetables, 24-hour timetables. Directions are hard to read. The font, the size of the writing is And the type of the font is also really important, that it's a very open and clear and large font. It's amazing how bad communications are on public transport, for example, when you get an announcement that a train is delayed. And, you know, you don't focus on it until you actually really listen to it, because one of your colleagues with intellectual disability has pointed out to you, it's like, it's just a gobbledygook. I mean, for most people, it's just like, what is that? What is that about? I mean, the verboseness of the language and the inaccessibility of the language for, I'd say, a lot of people is ridiculous, when you can say things so much more clearly. And it'll help everybody to understand better what actually is going on and what the solution is. So really, you know, honing in what is accessible language and what's not accessible language, and making sure that, you know, you're on the right side of that. A big issue that we have as well, in fact, I was just talking to one of our project workers, who's all our project workers have intellectual disability. I manage him, and we were just talking about the problems with abuse that is in the wider community for people with intellectual disability, because so often their disability is interpreted as a behavioural thing, or that in some ways they are deliberately mocking, or that there's some substance that they've consumed which has made them speak in a particular way, or that the fact that they need to ask questions that maybe other people might not need to ask is seen as annoying people, and they get really, really nasty responses, often from transport officials and people in the wider community, who all of whom should know better, but quite often who don't. And that need for raising awareness is absolutely huge still. And I think it's probably been this, I think it's actually, the problem's been intensified because the amount of privatisation that's happening in transport as well. So there hasn't been this carryover of the need to do disability awareness training for a lot of, for example, taxis, a lot of the privatised taxi services, the Ubers, or the all the different brands that are out there. They're not doing any disability awareness training, but they're happily refusing to give lifts to people with intellectual disability because they see them as being a little bit different. So they don't want to risk it, and they, even if they've called the taxi, they'll just drive off. But privatised buses, I've heard terrible stories about what's happened in terms of the way people with intellectual disability have been treated on buses, where clearly the staff have had no training at all in disability awareness. It's a huge problem.
It's a great, worrying example of the intersections between different systemic factors, you know, like a movement towards privatisation, a reduction in the amount of training that those workers are getting access to, and how it directly impacts on people with intellectual disability. It's not really there in the conversation so much around privatisation, you know, but there'd be so many of those examples about
what the problems are. It makes me, like, I cry internally when I hear some of these stories. You know, one of our members was telling me how she was abused by a taxi driver and told, you know, unfortunately what they're told is they're stupid and, you know, wake up and don't ask such stupid questions. And then when she says, "But I have an intellectual disability," well, what are you doing out on your own? You need to have somebody with you. You should have somebody with you. You shouldn't be allowed to go out on your own. But I just want to ask a question so I know how to go. So really aggressive, you know, abusive behaviour.
Just lack of kindness and respect,
Oh, absolutely. And just not, this is not a person with intellectual disability, but actually one of my neighbours who is in a wheelchair and has muscular dystrophy. And she was telling me that she's having terrible trouble getting buses because the buses, and they're all privatised around us, the buses will stop and see her in a wheelchair saying, oh, I haven't had any training using the lift, so you'll just have to wait until you find a bus driver who's had some training. And they'll drive off, leave her on the side of the road. She says sometimes she has to wait for two or three buses before the person will actually work the lift so that she can get up onto the bus. You know, the most, you know, it's incredible disrespect for a person with a disability. And this has been perpetuated by companies that must think it's okay for their staff to behave this way and to not be prioritising that the staff, as a requirement, must be trained to use the lift so that they can always allow people
before you start to drive a bus.
Get onto the buses, you know. It's a huge problem.
So fundamental, yeah. So conscious of time, we should wrap up pretty shortly, but are there any last things that you want to say or messages that you would want to give to other people campaigning?
I think it's a very, campaigning is a very rewarding space to work in. I think that we're working, I mean, we are continually moving into a digital space with a lot of our campaigning, but I think that's not to let go of. Often really powerful parts of campaigns are those face-to-face elements in campaigns. That's certainly where the rawness of face-to-face is really impactful. I mean, we get that, for example, where I ask members and supporters to go and visit their local MPs and empower them to. I do a lot of training, for example, on lobbying your local MP with our own members. You know, we'll do a lot of role play sessions and so that when you go, you'll feel that you know what you're doing. I know that's really, it's actually really great because I know one of our members, who lives down in Wollongong and has visited a Labor MP quite regularly, who's now fortunately a minister. He's saying how great it is that he now feels like, you know, he knows the MP really well. He can go and talk to him about any issue that is concerning, and the MP really listens to him as well. And you know, to have gone from not having any engagement at all with your MP to knowing that you can phone him up, make a meeting time, go and visit him, and that the MP is happy to meet with him as well and listen to what his issues are, and will try and address them. I mean, how empowering is that? Particularly if you're someone with an intellectual disability, to know that you've got those rights in society to be able to do that. So that is such a win, as far as I'm concerned, in the work that we do at CID, to know that we've empowered a whole lot of our members to be able to do that. And I guess in the wider society, I think that's such a powerful way to be able to engage with politicians and to affect change. So, yeah.
That's great. That's such a powerful story to finish on. It was also making me think, we interviewed Ellie Demishalia for a webinar we're doing soon, and she was talking about the power of people with disability on the campaign trail, because sometimes it's quite disarming for a politician or another kind of target to kind of, you know, or somebody even on a door or not doesn't want to, like, say no, or, you know, sometimes can be more receptive or open to.
Well, actually, I'll finish with one other little anecdote. I was part of the core committee organising the Stand By Me campaign, which was a big campaign to secure disability advocacy funding when the government of the day decided to remove all funding and close all the disability advocacy organisations down, including CID. And we'd got to a very good stage of the campaign. We'd run rallies. We'd done a lot of lobbying. We had lots of, you know, very impactful lots of rallies, not just in metropolitan Sydney, but right around New South Wales. And then we were going to do a big forum in Parliament House. And we were going to do the forum, go to question time. We had all of the friendly MPs lined up to do questions on disability advocacy funding. And I said, we're going to get everybody into the Parliament House. So I'm ringing up the people that organised, saying, so I've got another two people with wheelchairs coming. I've got another three people. This is getting like, there's about 15 people with wheelchairs coming. And I said, and I've already got 50 people up in the gallery. And they said, how many people are coming? I said, they keep RSVPing that they're coming. And I think, I don't know, but I think that that might have been what turned it, because we literally got to this stage where they were like, well, we can't accommodate any more wheelchairs. We can't do this. I said, well, they're coming. They're just going to be there because they're not. I can't tell them not to come. They're all coming. that same night, literally, I think the night before we were supposed to come, we get the phone call. Okay, you've got the money. we're going to fund you. So instead, the next day we ran a celebratory forum with all of the MPs, including the ones that had changed their mind, there in the photo to celebrate the fact that the disability advocacy funding had been reinstated. Mm. I think the whole thing about them suddenly thinking that Parliament House was going to be packed out with all of these people, you know, with the disability community. And obviously the media would have been informed that they were all going to be there as well, was a very, very powerful image, if you like, that they would have had to deal with.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's excellent. Wow, thanks, Rochelle. So good to talk campaigning with you.
You've been listening to Commons Conversations, produced by the Commons Social Change Library, a website containing over 1,000 resources for campaigners, all of which can be accessed for free at commonslibrary.org.